This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll get an update from an epidemiologist on COVID-19 booster shots and tips on staying safe during the holidays. We're joined by Shandy Dearth, director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, to get an update on COVID-19 in Indiana. Welcome back, Shandy.
Thank you for inviting me.
We heard at the top of the newscast here, I think we're going to just have to jump into this big story first, that the COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for children ages 5 to 11.
Yes, I'm super excited as a mom of an 11-year-old. I've been waiting for this day, so this will be the final person in my household to get vaccinated. So it's great news that this is available now. And it's actually even available in some places starting today here in Indiana. Many other local health departments will open it up tomorrow. And by Monday, most of the providers and pharmacies who are planning to give the vaccine will be ready to gear up and offer the vaccine to the public.
Well, one of my kids just turned 12, so that was the birthday present, was the vaccine. It was before they approved this, so we couldn't wait.
No, I understand completely. I'm sure the child will appreciate it when they're older, that they were protected as soon as possible.
Yeah. Well, the funny part is my daughter actually really wanted it. So she's like, now we can do things with other people, perhaps. So is that something that folks can look forward to if they're getting vaccinated, to actually interact with others?
Yes. As a mom of an unvaccinated kid, we've still been really careful. We haven't even flown in the last 2 years because he's not vaccinated yet. And so we're looking forward to planning that first trip on a plane for a while. And just hanging out with, other people, not being quite as worried about what we might encounter when we're out in public. So we're going to be a little looser with him once he's fully vaccinated. So I'm happy that your child was open to getting the vaccine. I've got to say, my son hates needles and really, really hates needles. And even he is sick of COVID. And he said he's ready to go get it this week. He just wants it over with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, New York is planning to vaccinate kids 5 to 11 beginning tomorrow through city vaccination sites and such. Do you know what the status is here in Indiana?
Yes. So we've got a pretty wide range of efforts out there in the community right now. So the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with the Indiana Department of Health is opening up again. So they're offering some drive-through clinic opportunities, which is great. So if you've got a kid who's a race fan, it might be a chance to take your kid there and get vaccinated. A lot of the county health departments are starting today. I know the Marion County Public Health Department will start opening up clinics tomorrow. They are offering vaccines through their district health offices and a few other sites around town. Anyone, no matter where you are in the state of Indiana, you can actually go to the ourshot.in.gov website, and you can put in your zip code and find the nearest location for your family.
I found interesting that lately it seems some of the vaccine hesitancy has shifted from folks who got vaccinated, and now they're worried about getting their kids vaccinated, thinking that if kids don't get as sick or have already gotten COVID, they don't need to get it. Can you help us dispel this myth?
Yes. So as a parent myself, I see that hesitancy because, you know, as an adult, you think, well, I'm willing to, you know, do this as an adult and make this decision. But when you're dealing with a smaller child, you know, I understand that hesitancy. But the great news is that the studies show that this vaccine is really, really effective. And although we hear a lot about kids who get COVID, they get it and they get over it, they're okay. What I want to caution everyone about is that some kids aren't okay. Some kids do have some long-term health effects. And a third of those kids who have ended up in the hospital, they didn't have any underlying health conditions. So I think a lot of parents who have a child in the household who doesn't have asthma or some other health issue, they just think, well, if my kid gets COVID, they're going to get over it, they'll be okay. And that's not necessarily guaranteed. But also, even though we're sick of COVID, this is still relatively a new disease when you look at the timeline of all the diseases that we have in the population. So we don't yet know the long-term effects of COVID on a child. So if my 11-year-old gets COVID today, I don't know if he's going to have some sort of thing pop up 5, 10, 15 years from now that could be related to COVID. I mean, we've seen that with other infectious diseases over time. We've seen how HPV can lead to cancer. We just don't know what COVID could eventually lead to. So go ahead and get your child vaccinated. If you're hesitant, I plead with you as a mom first and a public health person second. Talk to your child's pediatrician, and hopefully the pediatrician can reassure you that it's the right decision for you and your child.
I'm thinking about how when it comes to getting vaccines and people being hesitant, is there anything other than talking to the pediatrician that can get them, I guess, the information that they need to make them feel like this is the right choice?
That's a great question, because a lot of pediatricians are going to be slammed with questions right now, so it might be a few days before they can get back with you. A lot of pharmacists are very well trained on the topic as well, so call up one of your local pharmacists, talk with them. Talk to another parent who has decided to get their kiddo vaccinated. Also, there are lots of videos out there through CDC and other reputable public health agencies where they're highlighting infectious disease doctors who are parents themselves, and they're talking about why they chose to get their child vaccinated. So go to that person that you trust that has that science and health background who can walk you through that. And lots of people are willing to take the time to address those issues. And that's one reason we're kind of seeing the rollout for the kid vaccines to be different than we did for the adult vaccines, because we understand parents are going to have more questions about vaccinating their child than they did about vaccinating themselves. So that's why you're seeing a lot of these vaccinations will be done through appointments at pediatricians' offices, that sort of thing, versus the mass clinics that we saw with a lot of adults. It's because we're aware that those parents are going to want to talk with the healthcare provider before making that final decision. And that's fine. I just encourage everyone to be patient too, because, you know, a lot of us are really chomping at the bit to get our kiddo vaccinated as soon as possible. And so we expect kind of a surge in the next few days as people are calling health departments, pediatricians' offices, that sort of thing. But trust us, we've got lots of vaccine for your kiddos. You can get in, you can get that done.
The toddler years can be pretty tough as it is having toddlers, but being in a pandemic with toddlers and not being able to go out and do things, is there any information on children under the age of 5 when they may seek the emergency use authorization?
Yes. So we do expect more data from that study age group to come out towards the end of this year, beginning of next year. So hopefully like late winter, we could possibly see some vaccinations available for the younger crowd. And I feel for anyone who's been at home with a toddler during this. That's been my one saving grace, is at least my kids were older. Yeah. But I really give kudos to those parents who have survived COVID with the toddler at home.
That is a heroic feat to accomplish.
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
When it comes to COVID here in Indiana, how are the numbers looking so far? Are we doing better or worse than you expected at this point?
So we have been declining for a few weeks, which is great. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now these last few days is that we're starting to plateau. So we're flattening out. So that decline is stopping. We aren't seeing it go up yet, but we won't be surprised if it starts to climb again, just because it's getting colder. People are going indoors. All of the schools are now back from fall break. We kind of expected a bump after fall break, just because we saw that bump after spring break earlier in the year. And so we're keeping a close eye on that, especially in that K through 12 age range, just to see what happens. And again, as people go indoors and the masks are coming off indoors, we're worried about some more transmission.
Mm-hmm. And with the holidays coming up, I'm sure a lot of people want to gather with family and friends. Is there a safe way to do that?
Yes. Yeah, so I know last year we said, please just stay home with your household family members, but we didn't have vaccine available yet at that point. This year, we can approach it a little bit differently. So at this point, we can say, go ahead and gather in small family gatherings with your vaccinated family members. So if you've got, you know, a lot of people who are vocal about not getting vaccinated, you might want to try and break up your gatherings into some smaller groups. But also, if you can, again, being outside is great if you're with some unvaccinated family members. So if it's something where you could set up tables outside in a garage, on a deck, that sort of thing, ventilation is great when it comes to COVID. But try and keep it small, especially if you think you might have an unvaccinated person in the group, just so that you're limiting transmission. And, you know, talk with your elderly parents, your grandparents, make sure that they've got their booster shot that's available.
Yes. And let's talk about that real quick. Before I forget, we do need to talk about the booster shots. How can folks get those, and how important is it to get one?
So especially for the older populations, we've seen it can be pretty important, because immunity is deteriorating over time, especially as people get older. So the booster shot helps boost that immunity again. And the Indiana Department of Health has come out and said, look, if you want to get a booster shot, go ahead and go get one. So it's still available for free at all of the pharmacies where you would have gone to get your first or second dose. The health department still have it available. You can go into any local health department in the state and get that booster dose. and it's highly recommended. There's no reason not to get a booster dose. I know it says the guidance will often say if you're in any of these categories, you should consider getting a booster dose. But what we've seen is anyone with any kind of immune compromised system might be at a higher risk. And as we learn more about the disease, they keep adding more conditions onto that list. So if you think you might want to get a booster, just go ahead and get it. We've got plenty of vaccine available. It's not going to hurt you to get a booster. So just go ahead and do that. And that way, you know, you've got that little bit of immunity boost as you head into the holidays and you're around those family members.
Right, right. And I'll say I did get my booster shot and I didn't really have much of a reaction, just felt a little tired. So it's not scary.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great point. And that's another great point actually to share about the kid boosters. So what they saw in the study when they were looking at the younger age group, the 5 to 11, is those kiddos were not reporting the kind of, you know, effects that we adults were seeing after that, say, second or third dose. Mm-hmm. And so the kids were more likely to report, if anything at all, just being tired or maybe a bit of a headache, but not nearly to the extent that we saw the adults. So it's another reason to go ahead and consider getting your kid vaccinated. Go ahead and get that first dose in before Thanksgiving. How great would that be?
Yeah, that would be awesome to start the new year with a lot of folks vaccinated, and maybe we can get back to a little bit of normalcy.
Yes, I think we're all hoping for a very different 2022.
Yeah, definitely. Before we let you go, is there anything we should be concerned about moving forward with COVID, or are things kind of in a solid place right now?
I still encourage everyone to go ahead and get their flu vaccine as well. I mean, we still have pretty high transmission of COVID, even though the numbers are going down. We're not at a great spot yet. I'm not comfortable where we are right now, especially as it gets colder and we go indoors. But also, there was so much more campaigning around getting your flu vaccine last year. I haven't seen as much of that this year. It's still just as important to get your flu vaccine this year. We don't want to overload the healthcare system. Go ahead and get that flu vaccine. And that way, if you have the flu vaccine and you start to feel sick, if you really do have the flu, you're a lot less likely to be hospitalized. So just protect yourself, get that COVID booster, and go ahead and get that flu vaccine as well.
Thank you so much. Shandy Dearth is the director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Just ahead, a deep dive into environmental issues in Indiana. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, a big picture conversation on environmental issues with the outgoing head of the Hoosier Environmental Council. We're talking about environmental issues in Indiana, where the state has come in the last couple decades, why it's been difficult to get big changes to happen at the State House, and what advocates are hoping for in the coming years. We're joined by Jesse Carbonda, outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, can you tell us more about the Hoosier Environmental Council for folks who may not know what you do?
Absolutely. Hoosier Environmental Council has been around for 38 years, and we are Indiana's largest environmental public policy organization. In a nutshell, what we do is to advance environmental health and justice, protect land and water, and accelerate climate solutions.
What are the specific issues that are right now at the top of the list for the council?
Well, under the realm of environmental health and justice, I would say coal ash and factory farming. These are two issues that, you know, while we've made inroads on other aspects of environmental progress, such as, you know, the fact that we have a lot more land that's under cover cropping, which is helping to reduce nutrient pollution on our crop farm fields. Two areas that have been persistently a challenge for our state are factory farming and coal ash. You know, we have more coal ash waste pits than any state in America. And the way that we're handling the toxic metals that are leached into our groundwater is profoundly different from what's happening in southern states, which are just as conservative as in Indiana. So that's kind of a big area in under environmental health. We also have a dedicated environmental justice initiative, which is focused on Indianapolis. And there we're trying to make sure that the principles of environmental justice are embedded into projects, into plans, into policy. In the realm of protecting our land and water, we have a special focus on trying to make sure that we're doing everything possible to protect endangered woodlands and wetlands across the state. And we are involved in a really incredible partnership in the Indianapolis area called Partners for the White River, which is making a very dedicated effort to reduce various sources of pollution to our majestic White River and bring it back to a place where it really becomes the crown jewel of central Indiana.
How do you choose what's a priority to tackle over other environmental issues? Because there's so much going on, it seems like. So how do you figure out which one is like number one and then number two, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. You know, it's a humbling exercise because there are so many needs that we have to address in our state. But fundamentally, I say it's a three-part test. Is the initiative that we're working on going to have a significant impact on improving environmental quality? That's test one. Test two is it going to have a beneficial impact on the economy? In other words, will it foster new jobs and investment alongside protecting the environment? That's test two. And then test three is, will it have an equity benefit, either in terms of addressing imbalances in burdens facing people in our state, or from a climate perspective, are we helping to make sure that this initiative is making people who live past us better off?
You mentioned earlier the opportunity to show lawmakers what's happening. It might be one way to get them more interested to actually physically see something. Have you been able to do that at all? And if so, have you seen a dramatic shift in the way things were viewed?
I think it's something that we haven't pursued as consistently as we should have. We did have an instance, for example, several years ago where we took a combination of HEC members and elected officials to see a big renewable energy project up in White County. And there, you know, some of the misperceptions that some of these folks had about the technology, I think, were allayed. And, you know, the attitude about renewable energy in the state house is very different from what it was when I started back in 2007 at HEC. So I think that's a very concrete example. We've made some effort of taking them lawmakers out to see open space areas, but we have to do a lot more.
Is there any effort being made to find folks to run for government positions that have an environmental background? I wonder this because it just seems sometimes that if there's such a big disconnect between lawmakers and what's happening in the real world, we need some candidates that have some understanding of what's going on.
I agree. You know, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we can't get involved in candidate endorsements, but we certainly encourage people to run for office in a very generic sense. You know, we certainly encourage our members that to consider that as a pathway to addressing the fact that there aren't enough environmental champions in the state house. And, you know, that message, Miriam, is really a bipartisan one, which is to say that, you know, the polling shows that there are very different attitudes about the environment and climate between Democrats and Republicans. But I will say to you that there have been some really remarkable Republican champions for the environment in the state house as well. And so really, it's a message for both parties when I say, you know, run.
When it comes to your experience in environmental issues, it's clear you're passionate. You've been at this for a long time. Where did you get your start and how did you get involved in this area?
It's interesting. You know, in some ways, I'm a very unconventional environmentalist in the sense that I didn't grow up with parents who took me out to camping as a child. But I still had very meaningful experiences, you know, and I think the other sort of interesting aspect of this is, you know, I'm the son of immigrants. And so I'm not sure if immigrant families perhaps do that kind of camping as much as people whose families have lived in America for a long time. But in any case, I kind of trace three different sources for where my passion for the environment comes from. One is, it just so happens that I grew up in a part of suburban St. Louis in which my parents' home was adjacent to a large undeveloped parcel. And sometimes I would roam around there, and that certainly gave me a sense of the majesty of nature. You know, in addition to that, I was really blessed that my mother really believed that travel is a means of education. And so by the time my brother and I were in our teens, we had seen most of America and more than a few continents across the world, and certainly saw a lot of nature areas there. And then the third area that really, I think, sensitized me to environmental justice in particular is that you see this pronounced confluence between people who are poor and people who are suffering environmental burdens in a very pronounced way in developing countries. You know, a child that's begging for food in the middle of teeming amounts of traffic where there's a lot of diesel exhaust that child is having to inhale. So that really is kind of a very poignant influence in terms of shaping my care for environmental justice.
It's interesting you're mentioning the travel and seeing other parts of the world, because I'm wondering, I feel like, how am I going to put this? I'm trying to wrap my head around how I want to say this. But, you know, when you go to other parts of the world and you see, for example, piles of burning trash, and some of it is actually coming from the United States, how can we, I guess, bring more attention to that for folks to understand, like, it's not just our bubble here. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, you know, that kind of speaks to, in some sense, what I hope to do after I depart HEC, which is to begin book writing and really helping to get people to pay more attention to the kind of interconnectivity between what we do here and what happens abroad. You know, I think about the fact that our society is very addicted to meat, and, you know, that helps to fuel some of the damage that we're seeing abroad. I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, I think about what happens in the Amazon, where a lot of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil has been lost to livestock agriculture. Now, a lot of that meat is used in South America or exported to Asia and Europe, but some of it goes to America. And so that shows that the consumption decisions we make here, the purchasing decisions we make here, does have repercussions across the planet. The other kind of more obvious example of this is that America has historically been the leading emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, climate change is having profound imprints across the globe.
If you're listening to us live, we'd love your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Jesse Carbonda, outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, have you seen any changes or patterns in the last 14 years of the work that you've been doing here in Indiana?
Well, you know, what's an interesting aspect of the Indiana story when it comes to the environment is it's almost like we have two narratives. We've got the narrative of the legislature, which has become increasingly grim in some sense, because you have a large block of lawmakers who are really not interested in solving these big issues like coal ash and factory farming pollution. They're more interested in sort of sticking to a set of principles that essentially puts that almost puts a worship of certain attitudes about government above doing what's right for the people, you know, addressing real tangible problems. So that's a piece of the narrative that's kind of discouraging, although, again, I can furnish many examples of victories when the public mobilizes. The other narrative is that we have entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs and activists in Indiana who are doing incredibly inspiring things for the environment to such a degree that it's getting national attention. You know, I think about those corn and bean farmers who are at the forefront in America of cover cropping and no-till agriculture. I think of the climate activists, many of whom are in their high school years, who are helping to create climate public policies at the local level that have gotten national attention. So we've got an incredible number of talented and genuine and passionate people doing good work for the environment, but it's not being honored in terms of wise public policy that would put Indiana at the forefront. And that's a great change from what it once was. You know, Indiana was the first state in America, if I've got my facts straight, that banned the use of phosphorus-containing detergents in the early 1970s. So we really need to get back to that heritage of being an innovator in public policy for the environment.
Do you think we focus too much on negative outcomes, and that's why we're not noticing some of the wins here and there that have been made?
Well, you know, we try to do both. We try to give people the hard truth of problems that really would have an impact on people's drinking water or their air quality. But we also want to provide many examples of hope. And that's why I like to emphasize and talk about, you know, these amazing entrepreneurs who are, say, helping to create jobs in a underinvested part of rural Indiana in the realm of solar energy, or people who are, again, involved in solar energy who are very intentionally locating their business in underinvested areas in urban Indiana. So I think we've got to tell both stories, right? The positive stories give people hope. They give people encouragement that Indiana can be a leader, can help to solve these problems. But we have to be candid with everybody about the nature of the problems, because otherwise we're going to see people needlessly suffer.
Are you noticing any changes in the way the public thinks and talks about environmental issues?
I would say that it has become more mainstream. And what gives me a sense to say that is because I've been struck by the number of companies, corporations that have green teams within their company. And I don't see these as window dressing in terms of my personal experience. These are green teams where you have employees who earnestly want to green the operations of the company. It may be in more modest ways, like instituting recycling or composting, or having a dedicated parking spot for an electric vehicle or for a bike. Or it could be in more significant ways, which is to try to really influence executive leadership to have a strong, aggressive climate action plan. So I think that's one example of how attitudes have changed about the environment. I think the way in which environmental stewardship and the notion of creation care has permeated people of faith, congregations of faith, I think has been a very positive example of kind of the cultural change we've seen in our state.
When it comes to environmental issues, I think a topic that often comes up is funding and whether there's enough to go around. Do you think there's enough? Has it been cut?
Yes. Unfortunately, funding, I'll give you two examples of where there's been cuts. One is in the realm of IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, basically the state's equivalent of the US EPA. And on a per capita basis, they've seen a decline, as well as an absolute basis, they've seen a decline in their funding since the early 2000s. And we've also seen it with respect to open space protection. You know, there's a very important initiative called the Benjamin Harrison Conservation Trust, and it is a source of helping to save woodlands and wetlands and prairies that are potentially vulnerable to development. And funding for that has declined significantly. So we need to place a lot higher priority on the environment, not just for the sake of protecting wildlife and creating more beautiful spaces for people to enjoy, but because it really matters from an economic perspective. The recreational sector in Indiana alone employs about 140,000 people.
That's a lot of people. That's a pretty good number.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and one of the themes of my years at HEC is to really emphasize the fact that if we have the right public policies in place, we can pave the way for more of these types of what I would call sustainable economy jobs. I think about, again, solar energy, where we have so much promise to be a national leader in solar energy because we have so many, for example, warehouses in our state. We're trying to be a warehouse hub in the country because we do have a high density of highways. So that makes us a very logical place to have warehouses. But guess what? Almost none of them have any solar energy. And yet, if we were to put these solar panels up, we could help to obviously power our energy in emissions-free ways and also save land. Since the new sources of energy, like utility-scale solar farms, do use a lot of land. Why not have that power come from our rooftops.
Have you heard of why companies wouldn't be interested in putting solar panels? Is it the cost?
Well, you know, the cost has gotten a lot better. Solar energy has declined on a megawatt basis, on a kilowatt basis, by 65 to 70% since a decade ago. So that definitely makes the economics of these projects better. But one of the problems is that the bill that I'd referenced earlier, SB 309, really hurts the economics of these rooftop solar projects. Indiana's in the minority of states that legislatively phased out this public policy called net metering. And furthermore, what we've seen happen in the implementation of net metering by way of what the utilities are doing, Duke Energy, AES Indiana, the other three investor-owned utilities, is that they have interpreted SB 309 in a way that even further worsens the economics of these rooftop solar projects by eliminating this concept called net billing, which really, again, makes these projects more attractive.
Coming up, guest host Jeannie Lindsay looks into the challenges child care providers are facing in the state. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Today is the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, guest host Jeannie Lindsay learned about challenges child care providers are facing in Indiana and how things have worsened during the pandemic.
We're joined by Nicole Norvell, director of the Indiana Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning, and Debbie DeBruin, president and CEO of Right Steps Child Development Centers. So, Nicole, we've talked quite a bit about congressional funding, pandemic-related relief. I'm curious, from your perspective at the state level, what sort of things are you watching the federal government on in terms of further support for early childhood education? I'm curious if there's any changes that you're keeping eyes on or looking out for.
We're certainly looking at bills, you know, that are sitting in Congress today related to early childhood. We always keep an eye on those just because we want to be sure we are prepared. I think we're also really looking to our federal partners for continued guidance around, one, how to best use these funds, but two, you know, as it relates to COVID, understanding that vaccines are not yet available for children in most of our child care programs, you know, understanding what are all the safety precautions we need to continue to take, I think has just been a really important partnership.
So one of the things I wanted to explore a little bit more is sort of the rural-urban divide. So Debbie, I wanted to speak with you about this. You work with providers in rural counties. Can you tell us about some of the experiences or different circumstances that differ? I mean, what is it like running a program in some of the more rural parts of the state?
Oh, you know what? It's so much fun because they just are so appreciative of all of the back end things that we're doing to assist. I think one of the most incredible things about our more rural counties is they have individuals that know that early childhood education needs should be a priority for their community. They even are really tremendous at raising the funds, like I said earlier, to get the building built, initially to get staffing underway. But then they run into lots of problems, like they don't really understand. It's a very complicated business from the business end. So when Nicole talked about all the different funding streams that could potentially fund one child or a family or however, you know, those have to be managed and they have to be recorded and they have to be journaled and audited and claimed. And so just from that perspective, it's really hard. A lot of times, too, they don't have the expertise living in the community to provide all of the expertise and the what's needed as far as really developing a high quality, in our case, nationally accredited early childhood center. So we're able to do that. We've taken over all of their HR and management operations. And then we basically bill the community once a month. They still own it. It's theirs locally, We just do the day-to-day management and operation of it. So it's really ended up being a wonderful partnership, both in Remington and in Goodland. And now in the first part of 2022, we're going to be opening another center in Rensselaer with Appleseed Childhood Education, a nonprofit group that has done exactly the same thing. And we're going to come in and do the same, the day-to-day operation and management of that center as well.
Right. The rural areas come with a whole different community feel when it comes to the service provided, but also the support for it, too.
Yeah, they just don't have the access, and they don't have the number of people. And what they do have is the commitment, which if they have the commitment, then the rest of it we can work out.
Right. Well, we have a listener voicemail from Jerome who has a couple questions about early childhood education. Let's listen.
Yes, this is Jerome Eckel from Evansville, Indiana, and I'm calling about child care and your guest's opinion about the need for Indiana to change its education support system to include preschool along with K through 12 education. Secondly, I'd like to know your guest's opinion about the federal legislation that's currently pending that supports early childhood education. Thank you.
So, Nicole, would you like to start?
Sure. So I think in reference to his first question about whether or not we should be kind of all one big system, you know, here's what I would say, which is I agree wholeheartedly with Debbie that learning begins at birth. I mean, what we now know about the way children and their brains develop in that birth to five continuum, we understand that children are learning more in that time than they are in almost any other time. Their brain is developing faster, and it really sets the stage for what should happen for them in later life. What I would tell you, though, is early childhood education is very different than K-12 education. So if you walked into one of Debbie's centers, you're not going to see children sitting at desk facing forward, learning in that way. You're going to see them at various interactive play stations, them doing different things with their hands and their senses and learning in ways that is very different. So I think we always want to be really thoughtful about how we think about education and just understanding that based on the development of the child, it should look different. And how do we not try to make it all the same? I think that's really important. In terms of his second question about what Congress is doing, we certainly are watching that very closely. What I would say is I have been in government long enough to know that we probably shouldn't plan for anything until the bill is all the way done. It'll change a lot between now and then. But I do think what's really exciting is that we see a continued focus and realization that early childhood education is important and access to it for parents is really important for not only them and their children, but really for economic recovery. And so regardless, I think it's super exciting to see that people are interested in taking steps to really make the system better.
Yeah. And Debbie, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Boy, I just absolutely agree with her. I really do. And I do think one of the points that she made that birth to five learning is so different. And I think that's so compelling what she said, but it's so critical for the overall development of the person. And I do love that our high quality providers are able to do that. And I don't know that it needs to be in a school setting. I just think it needs to be paid as closely attention and funded as appropriately as all education.
Yeah. And Nicole, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about as well, is sort of the perception of early childhood education and how that sort of changed over time. I'm curious from your perspective, what sort of things that you have changed about the way you talk about it or encouraged others in terms of the way that they talk about this early learning childcare space to really hone in and make clear the educational side of it, in addition to having care for families.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think even the terminology that's used in the field today is really different than it was before. So even today, the three of us are talking about early childhood education. We're not saying daycare, certainly not saying babysitting. And I think, you know, just over the course of the history of the field, we're trying to ensure that even the way we refer to it, we're articulating what's happening in that environment. I think that that's just really important. You know, I think the other piece is, the state deserves a lot of credit from those who were strong advocates and to our state legislature for On My Way Pre-K, and really not just saying that there was a focus on pre-K, but a focus on high quality pre-K. And I think because of that, we've been able to really educate our communities about why early learning is important, not just in that pre-K year, but for that child's entire experience. And I think as we continue to move forward, it will take all of us, you know, our advocates, our community leaders, our state leaders, to help everyone understand the importance of what's happening in those environments every day.
And Debbie, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, with the talk a lot about funding support and, you know, the way that things have changed during the pandemic, I'm curious from your perspective, what more needs to happen other than funding, you know, looking ahead to sustain this industry, to, you know, ensure consistency for families? I'm curious what sort of things, you know, you would suggest or would like to see change outside of funding levels.
Then I guess number one, I just would like for every single solitary child that is birth to five to have some sort of experience before they start school, some kind of curriculum-based early learning experience, whether it's a high-quality home provider or a high-quality center. It really, that part really doesn't matter. But what really does matter is all of the things that we teach. Even we begin with our infants. We have a curriculum for our infants. A lot of people don't realize that, but we do. Everything we do has a purpose. So I really think that mindset, and we just don't yet have the capacity. I mean, we talk a lot about it. And I think, you know, since I've been at Right Steps for the last 4 years, that's really all I've heard from the state is capacity and quality. And I could not agree more with that. I do think funding is a critical piece of that, and we have spent a lot of time talking about that and how exciting that we're talking about it in a positive light right now, which is wonderful. And then I, you know, just really recognizing the efforts of our staff that work with these little ones every single day, day in and day out, and the qualifications and the trainings and all of the things that are required of them. A true recognition of them, I think, is certainly warranted.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's similar to, I cover education, and we've been hearing a lot about K-12 teachers, but childcare staff and people who provide this essential service, you know, it's important to recognize and talk about them as well. Nicole, I'm curious what you see as maybe some of the greatest needs for how the structure of childcare resources and services, you know, at the state or policy level, what sort of things you envision as a need to sustain the industry moving forward or improve it, given all the things that we've learned during the pandemic? What are some things that stand out to you outside of funding?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work to do. I think funding is really important, but I also think the infrastructure of the funding mechanisms we have today needs some work. You know, the money really stays with that child. And while there is good to that, it's also difficult if you're a childcare provider to do a budget that is changing on you all the time. And so the infrastructure, I think, of the way that we approach it is definitely something that we will be working towards changing. We also need to look at how we give our early childhood education teachers greater access to higher education, to, you know, career pathways that make sense for them in terms of, you know, what they want to do long term and how we can help them increase those competencies that they need in order to be effective with children. And we know we have a lot of work to do around diversity. We know that there are communities in this state that have less access than others. We also know that our workforce does not look like the children oftentimes that they are teaching, and we want to change that as well. So we have a lot of work to do, but really exciting things, and certainly know that the partnerships in Indiana are so strong and believe that we'll be able to accomplish a lot here over the next couple of years.
Yeah, of course. Debbie, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is sort of what changes have come to Right Steps that you see, continuing, moving forward. I know one of the things that I've heard a lot about during the pandemic is, you know, the flexibility or adaptability or, you know, things that people have learned that they do better now. So I'm curious if there's been anything that stood out to you during the pandemic that Right Steps has learned or that you have learned that you plan to carry with you forward as you continue working in this field?
Well, I thought for a long time that you can sit in an office from 8 to 5 and get nothing accomplished, or you can really work anywhere. You can work at home and be equally as productive or oftentimes more productive. So I'm happy that we're taking a look at that. I agree with that completely. In the center specifically, obviously, we're open 12 hours a day, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So we're trying to cover 12 hours every single day. However, we are really trying to think outside of the box and look at flexibility with our teachers. And we're doing that right now. Instead of your traditional, 8-hour workday or whatever, if we can do some things like that to help families, that's our ideal. Also, more and more, even retirees that just want to come in and spend a few hours a day with our children, kind of like the schools do with their paras. We're really looking at that. So we're ever changing. And I think one of the things that has meant the most to me is really recognizing that there is a lot of stress. And I think that's in our workforce in general. Of course, I'm focusing more on our staff at Right Steps, but really paying attention to that and trying to surround our staff with resources such as like the employee assistance program that we're starting in November to really support our staff and their families in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of the whole person approach and leveraging more of that people power. Nicole, we don't have much time left, but in 45 seconds, can you talk a little bit about the resources for families?
Yes. So I would say for all families, you absolutely can start, if you're looking for care, at childcarefinder.in.gov. It's going to be the best place for you to start that exploration and what's available around you. There's a great route to work feature where you can type in where you live and where you work. And it's going to show you all the child cares on your route so that you can see what's most available to you. I would also say that if you're a family who works in an essential field, and please know that that definition is very broad, so don't think it doesn't include you because it might, you can go to the Build, Learn, Grow website where we have all kinds of information about scholarships that might be able to help you, programs that are accepting those scholarships and the ways that you apply.
And that's it for the Friday Recap. We'll see you again next week. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, and you can always leave us a voice message at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.